University of Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. November Examination Series 2014. English as a Second Language. Core Tier, Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at questions 1 to 6. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answers should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. What is the man doing today after his haircut?
Good morning, and what can I do for you today, sir?
I've come to have my hair cut, please. I'm starting work tomorrow and need to look good. Can you cut it straight away? I'm meeting my friend in an hour.
I'll be with you in 5 minutes. Good morning, and what can I do for you today, sir?
I've come to have my hair cut, please. I'm starting work tomorrow and need to look good. Can you cut it straight away? I'm meeting my friend in an hour.
I'll be with you in 5 minutes.
Question 2. What kind of boat does the girl decide to hire?
We'd like to hire one of your boats, please.
What would you like? We have rowing boats, sailing boats, or canoes.
We'll take a canoe, please.
OK. Oh, I'm sorry. They're all out on the lake.
In that case, can we have a rowing boat, please, for 1 hour?
That'll be £10.
We'd like to hire one of your boats, please.
What would you like? We have rowing boats, sailing boats, or canoes.
We'll take a canoe, please.
OK. Oh, I'm sorry. They're all out on the lake.
In that case, can we have a rowing boat, please, for 1 hour?
That'll be £10.
Question 3. What had Benji borrowed from his friend, Jen?
Hi, Jen. I've just come round to return this to you.
Oh, my computer game. Thanks, Benji. I'd almost forgotten I'd lent it to you. What did you think of it?
It was really good. I've also bought round this DVD for us to watch.
Great. Come on in.
Hi, Jen. I've just come round to return this to you.
Oh, my computer game. Thanks, Benji. I'd almost forgotten I'd lent it to you. What did you think of it?
It was really good. I've also bought round this DVD for us to watch.
Great. Come on in.
Question 4. What will the boy give his mother for her birthday?
Oh, dear Marie. I just don't know what to buy my mum for her birthday. I've just found this box of chocolates, but she's trying to lose weight.
So maybe not chocolates. What about flowers? But I've got a better idea. In the market, there were some big baskets of fruit. They look beautiful. You could buy her one of those. And maybe get a small bar of chocolate and put that in the basket too.
Great idea. But I won't get the chocolate. I'll put a ribbon round the basket to make it look nice. That will be perfect. Oh, dear Marie. I just don't know what to buy my mum for her birthday. I've just found this box of chocolates, but she's trying to lose weight.
So maybe not chocolates. What about flowers? But I've got a better idea. In the market, there were some big baskets of fruit. They look beautiful. You could buy her one of those. And maybe get a small bar of chocolate and put that in the basket too.
Great idea. But I won't get the chocolate. I'll put a ribbon round the basket to make it look nice. That will be perfect.
Question 5. What sort of book does the girl decide to read?
Excuse me, Mr. Hathaway, but I wondered if you could help me choose a new book to read. I just don't know where to begin.
Of course, I'll do my best. Let's see. Perhaps start by telling me your favourite kind of book. Do you like spy stories?
I think I've read all the best ones in that section. And I've read all the romance fiction in this library.
Would you be interested in reading about what life might be like in the future? The science fiction section might interest you. Take a look. It's just below the history section.
Thanks. I'll try it. Excuse me, Mr. Hathaway, but I wondered if you could help me choose a new book to read. I just don't know where to begin.
Of course, I'll do my best. Let's see. Perhaps start by telling me your favourite kind of book. Do you like spy stories?
I think I've read all the best ones in that section. And I've read all the romance fiction in this library.
Would you be interested in reading about what life might be like in the future? The science fiction section might interest you. Take a look. It's just below the history section.
Thanks. I'll try it.
Question 6. A. What is Ahmed doing on Tuesday, the 17th of November? B. Give the date of his new appointment.
Hello. My name's Ahmed Jaffrey. I have an appointment with the dentist on Tuesday the 17th of November. I'm phoning to postpone it, I'm afraid. I've got my driving test that day. Can I make a new appointment?
Yes, of course. Can you manage the following week, Thursday the 26th?
That's no good for me. How about Friday the 27th?
Yes, that's fine. Is 10:30 okay for you?
Yes, thank you. Hello, my name's Ahmed Jaffrey. I have an appointment with the dentist on Tuesday the 17th of November. I'm phoning to postpone it, I'm afraid. I've got my driving test that day. Can I make a new appointment?
Yes, of course. Can you manage the following week, Thursday the 26th?
That's no good for me. How about Friday the 27th?
Yes, that's fine. Is 10:30 okay for you?
Yes, thank you.
That is the last of questions 1 to 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. Listen to the following interview with a man called Lars Eriksson, who works in a hotel made of ice. Then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
D.
Today we have Lars Eriksson here to talk to our tourism class all about a new hotel that has recently opened in Sweden.
Actually, it opened some years ago, so it's not really new. But then, in another way, it is new, because it has to be rebuilt every year. Let me explain. When we built our hotel, we wanted to use a different construction material, instead of the normal concrete and glass. I suppose we could have used local materials such as wood and stone, but in the end we decided to build it entirely from snow and ice.
Perhaps you could tell us a little about the origin of this hotel. Who first had the idea of sleeping and staying in a building made of ice?
It came about almost by accident. It started in 1989, when some ice sculptors visited the town and held an exhibition in the town hall. Then the following spring, an artist came from France and held his exhibition in a room he had built out of ice blocks. One night, there were no rooms available in the normal hotels in town, and some visitors asked permission to spend the night in the ice room. And so the idea of the ice hotel was born.
So, how is your hotel made?
When the temperature drops in November, the building starts. The snow is sprayed onto huge steel structures, which are like giant moulds. When the snow has frozen solid, the moulds are removed and a maze of corridors is left behind. In early December, artists move in to design and build the rooms, and the hotel is ready for visitors by mid-December. But it doesn't last very long. By the end of April, everything has melted away.
And how much snow and ice do you use every year?
In March every year, the ice hotel collects snow and ice from the frozen River Torn, which is nearby. They collect over 10,000 tons of ice, which is then stored and used for creating ice sculptures. About 4,000 tons of it is used for art sculpture classes. We then collect 30,000 tons of snow, which is stored until we need it for the construction of the hotel later in the year.
Tell us more about what it is like inside the hotel.
Our hotel is the largest ice hotel in the world. It covers around 6,000 square meters. The hotel has a restaurant and coffee shop, a reception, and hotel rooms for over 100 guests. Everything in the hotel is made of ice, including the glasses you drink from, the chairs, and the beds.
Oh dear, I'm afraid that doesn't sound very comfortable. How do you get any sleep on a bed of ice?
The temperature is always between -5 and -8 Celsius, and that's very cold indeed. But the ice bed has a thick mattress that rests on a wooden base. To go to sleep, you get into a sleeping bag, so you actually feel very warm.
That's reassuring. And how do the guests spend their days?
In the morning, the staff wake you up with a cup of hot fruit juice. Then there are all sorts of interesting activities. You might choose skiing or skating lessons, camping in the frozen wilderness, or a ride on a sled pulled by a team of trained dogs.
It sounds great.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Today we have Lars Eriksson here to talk to our tourism class all about a new hotel that has recently opened in Sweden.
Actually, it opened some years ago, so it's not really new. But then, in another way, it is new, because it has to be rebuilt every year. Let me explain. When we built our hotel, we wanted to use a different construction material, instead of the normal concrete and glass. I suppose we could have used local materials such as wood and stone, but in the end we decided to build it entirely from snow and ice.
Perhaps you could tell us a little about the origin of this hotel. Who first had the idea of sleeping and staying in a building made of ice?
It came about almost by accident. It started in 1989, when some ice sculptors visited the town and held an exhibition in the town hall. Then the following spring, an artist came from France and held his exhibition in a room he had built out of ice blocks. One night, there were no rooms available in the normal hotels in town, and some visitors asked permission to spend the night in the ice room. And so the idea of the ice hotel was born.
So how is your hotel made?
When the temperature drops in November, the building starts. The snow is sprayed onto huge steel structures, which are like giant molds. When the snow has frozen solid, the molds are removed and a maze of corridors is left behind. In early December, artists move in to design and build the rooms, and the hotel is ready for visitors by mid-December. But it doesn't last very long. By the end of April, everything has melted away.
And how much snow and ice do you use every year?
In March every year, the ice hotel collects snow and ice from the frozen River Tourne, which is nearby. They collect over 10,000 tons of ice, which is then stored and used for creating ice sculptures. About 4,000 tons of it is used for art sculpture classes. We then collect 30,000 tons of snow, which is stored until we need it for the construction of the hotel later in the year.
Tell us more about what it is like inside the hotel.
Our hotel is the largest ice hotel in the world. It covers around 6,000 square meters. The hotel has a restaurant and coffee shop, a reception, and hotel rooms for over 100 guests. Everything in the hotel is made of ice, including the glasses you drink from, the chairs, and the beds.
Oh dear, I'm afraid that doesn't sound very comfortable. How do you get any sleep on a bed of ice?
The temperature is always between -5 and -8 Celsius, and that's very cold indeed. But the ice bed has a thick mattress that rests on a wooden base. To go to sleep, you get into a sleeping bag, so you actually feel very warm.
That's reassuring. And how do the guests spend their days?
In the morning, the staff wake you up with a cup of hot fruit juice. Then there are all sorts of interesting activities. You might choose skiing or skating lessons, camping in the frozen wilderness, or a ride on a sled pulled by a team of trained dogs.
It sounds great.
That is the end of question 7. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Listen to the following talk about a spacecraft and the gold disc that it carries. Then complete the following details. You will hear the talk twice.
Today I'm going to tell you about a spacecraft that was launched into space many years ago, in 1977. Its name, Voyager 1. And this spacecraft, amazingly, is still flying strong. In 2012, Voyager 1 was the first spacecraft ever to reach outer space. In fact, it's now 18 billion kilometers away from Earth. Voyager 2, a similar spacecraft, is 14.8 billion kilometers away. Voyager 1 is actually a very small craft. It's about 3.7 meters across and weighs 722 kilos. That's not much bigger than a family car and not much heavier than a washing machine. Of course, the rocket that launched it was quite enormous in comparison. The project has cost a lot of money. But how can you put a price on the fascinating photographs sent back from Jupiter, showing that there are volcanoes on one of its moons? And the detailed images of Saturn's rings have amazed the world. So, how advanced is the technology on this tiny spacecraft? Well, very poor by today's standards. In fact, the average smartphone in 2014 has thousands of times more memory than Voyager 1. Yet most of the instruments on board the vessel still work, and they continue to send signals back to Earth. The scientific team in charge of it believes it still has enough power to operate all its instruments until the year 2020, when they will start shutting down one by one, until the spacecraft finally goes silent in 2025. But besides all the scientific equipment, Voyager 1 carries on board a really interesting item, a large disc made out of solid gold. So what did they put on this disc? The scientists interviewed members of the public and asked what images they would like to include. Younger pupils at school suggested pets and wild animals. Teenagers favoured film stars. Adults preferred historical figures. There are audio recordings too. There are examples of music from a range of different cultures. The disc contains greetings in 56 different languages. There are other natural sounds, such as thunderstorms. And there are some personal messages from world leaders too. The scientists made the final decisions. They selected pictures and sounds in order to represent the diversity of life forms on our planet. In addition, they included many images of scientific interest, such as diagrams of the solar system and its planets. They hope that the disc will give any intelligent life forms in the future an idea of what we were like in the 20th century. You may be asking yourself how a being from outer space will be able to play such a disc. Well, the instructions are engraved on its metal cover. Let's hope they can read English and have the right kind of equipment to play these discs. Meanwhile, it seems Voyager 1 is destined to wander the Milky Way forever.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Today I'm going to tell you about a spacecraft that was launched into space many years ago, in 1977. Its name, Voyager 1. And this spacecraft, amazingly, is still flying strong. In 2012, Voyager 1 was the first spacecraft ever to reach outer space. In fact, it's now 18 billion kilometers away from Earth. Voyager 2, a similar spacecraft, is 14.8 billion kilometers away. Voyager 1 is actually a very small craft. It's about 3.7 meters across and weighs 722 kilos. That's not much bigger than a family car and not much heavier than a washing machine. Of course, the rocket that launched it was quite enormous in comparison. The project has cost a lot of money, but how can you put a price on the fascinating photographs sent back from Jupiter, showing that there are volcanoes on one of its moons? And the detailed images of Saturn's rings have amazed the world. So, how advanced is the technology on this tiny spacecraft? Well, very poor by today's standards. In fact, the average smartphone in 2014 has thousands of times more memory than Voyager 1. Yet most of the instruments on board the vessel still work, and they continue to send signals back to Earth. The scientific team in charge of it believes it still has enough power to operate all its instruments until the year 2020, when they will start shutting down one by one, until the spacecraft finally goes silent in 2025. But besides all the scientific equipment, Voyager 1 carries on board a really interesting item: a large disc made out of solid gold. So what did they put on this disc? The scientists interviewed members of the public and asked what images they would like to include. Younger pupils at school suggested pets and wild animals. Teenagers favoured film stars. Adults preferred historical figures. There are audio recordings too. There are examples of music from a range of different cultures. The disc contains greetings in 56 different languages. There are other natural sounds, such as thunderstorms. And there are some personal messages from world leaders too. The scientists made the final decisions. They selected pictures and sounds in order to represent the diversity of life forms on our planet. In addition, they included many images of scientific interest, such as diagrams of the solar system and its planets. They hope that the disc will give any intelligent life forms in the future an idea of what we were like in the 20th century. You may be asking yourself how a being from outer space will be able to play such a disc. Well, the instructions are engraved on its metal cover. Let's hope they can read English and have the right kind of equipment to play these discs. Meanwhile, it seems Voyager 1 is destined to wander the Milky Way forever.
That is the end of question 8. In a moment, you'll hear question 9. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 9. Listen to the following talk about a famous sportsman, Usain Bolt, and then show whether each statement is true or false by putting a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the talk twice.
Usain Bolt is a unique sportsman, probably the fastest human being that has ever lived. But what makes him so different is his attitude as well as his obvious talent. Not only does he regularly break world records, but he does so with humour and makes it look easy. At the Beijing Olympics, he won his race with his shoelaces untied. Another time, he winked playfully at the TV cameras whilst warming up. In the 2012 Olympic Games, when he'd crossed the finishing line, he did 5 push-ups, 1 for each of his Olympic gold medals. He didn't seem tired at all and wanted everyone to know it. So what was life like for him as a child? His family was not wealthy. He went to an ordinary school in a small town in northwest Jamaica. Usain lived with his parents, brother and sister in a modest bungalow. Nowadays, he still lives with his brother, but in an exclusive apartment in the capital, along with a bodyguard and a chef. As a child, he was hyperactive, easily bored, and was even known to run off to the nearby town to play arcade games there. But he showed his talent early on and was a natural sprinter, doing best at shorter, faster races. He won many competitions at school, then at national level in Jamaica, but he was not always successful due to a lack of determination. Then came the turning point. At the age of 15, he won the 200 metres at the 2002 World Junior Championships. Immediately afterwards, he was given the nickname of Lightning Bolt. This altered his whole attitude, and it struck him that he had the ability to be something very special. He felt the burning need to win. He went on to win lots of gold medals, for example at the 2012 Olympic Games in London and in Moscow in 2013. What makes him such a good athlete? Is it down to luck or having the right build of body? He admits that he has natural ability. He doesn't seem to have to take much care with his diet. Many athletes ensure they eat exactly the right combination of proteins and carbohydrates and will restrict their diet to lean meat and pasta during training periods. Usain, on the other hand, enjoys fried potatoes and chicken nuggets. He certainly seems to do well on this combination. But he explains that in order to win major races, he has to train hard. Firstly, he is tall, which makes him heavier than many of his rivals and slower out of the starting blocks. He also has one leg slightly shorter than the other. So every morning he starts exercising at 6:30, practicing his starts and his reaction times, working on different techniques. His level of success demands determination and hard work. He is also a talented cricketer and footballer. In fact, he has recently said that if offered the chance, he would like to play football for Manchester United. With his determination and talent, who knows? This might be a possibility when he decides to retire from athletics. With Usain Bolt, anything is possible.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Usain Bolt is a unique sportsman, probably the fastest human being that has ever lived. But what makes him so different is his attitude as well as his obvious talent. Not only does he regularly break world records, but he does so with humour and makes it look easy. At the Beijing Olympics, he won his race with his shoelaces untied. Another time, he winked playfully at the TV cameras whilst warming up. In the 2012 Olympic Games, when he'd crossed the finishing line, he did 5 push-ups, 1 for each of his Olympic gold medals. He didn't seem tired at all and wanted everyone to know it. So what was life like for him as a child? His family was not wealthy. He went to an ordinary school in a small town in northwest Jamaica. Usain lived with his parents, brother and sister in a modest bungalow. Nowadays, he still lives with his brother, but in an exclusive apartment in the capital, along with a bodyguard and a chef. As a child, he was hyperactive, easily bored, and was even known to run off to the nearby town to play arcade games there. but he showed his talent early on and was a natural sprinter, doing best at shorter, faster races. He won many competitions at school, then at national level in Jamaica, but he was not always successful due to a lack of determination. Then came the turning point. At the age of 15, he won the 200 metres at the 2002 World Junior Championships. Immediately afterwards, he was given the nickname of Lightning Bolt. This altered his whole attitude, and it struck him that he had the ability to be something very special. He felt the burning need to win. He went on to win lots of gold medals, for example at the 2012 Olympic Games in London and in Moscow in 2013. What makes him such a good athlete? Is it down to luck or having the right build of body? He admits that he has natural ability. He doesn't seem to have to take much care with his diet. Many athletes ensure they eat exactly the right combination of proteins and carbohydrates and will restrict their diet to lean meat and pasta during training periods. Usain, on the other hand, enjoys fried potatoes and chicken nuggets. He certainly seems to do well on this combination. But he explains that in order to win major races, he has to train hard. Firstly, he is tall, which makes him heavier than many of his rivals and slower out of the starting blocks. He also has one leg slightly shorter than the other. So every morning he starts exercising at 6:30, practicing his starts and his reaction times, working on different techniques. His level of success demands determination and hard work. He is also a talented cricketer and footballer. In fact, he has recently said that if offered the chance, he would like to play football for Manchester United. With his determination and talent, who knows? This might be a possibility when he decides to retire from athletics. With Usain Bolt, anything is possible.
That is the end of question 9. In a moment, you will hear question 10. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 10. Listen to the following interview with Dr. Novak about Easter Island, and then indicate which statement, A, B, or C, best completes the sentence by putting a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Good evening, Dr. Novak, and thank you for taking the time to tell us about your work on Easter Island.
We prefer to call it Rapa Nui, the name used by the inhabitants. It's a very remote island in the South Pacific, thousands of kilometres from the nearest continent and 2,000 kilometres from the next closest inhabited island. In fact, it's the most isolated inhabited place in the world. In the 17th century, it was home to around 15,000 people, but after various disasters, the numbers steadily declined until the present day, when there are just 5,800 people left.
Tell us about the Easter Island statues.
Well, I first visited in 1982. I already knew that each one is about 9.8 metres tall and weighs around 82 tonnes. But what really amazed me was the number of these statues. There are over 1,000, most still upright. The enormous heads, carved out of rock, all face the same direction. The people believe that these statues have special powers and are placed in such a way to protect the people.
How did they move them into position?
1,000 years ago, the island was thickly covered in trees. One theory was that the islanders used trees as rollers. It was thought that the islanders destroyed every tree on their island for this purpose. But now we believe that teams of around 20 people, using ropes, rocked the statue back and forth, each time moving it forward a little more. We no longer think that animals were involved in transporting the statues.
Have you made any other discoveries recently?
In 2012, we found that the stone heads actually have bodies. These are well hidden, buried deep in the earth. We can now see that some statues are even bigger than we thought. There's also evidence that the statues were painted at one time. We know that the islanders painted their own bodies in a similar way.
Have archaeologists found anything else there, apart from the statues?
We have unearthed over 500 stone tools, showing that different tools were used for different types of carving. There are axes and picks for coarse work, thin, sharp blades for detailed work, and small tools for rubbing the surfaces and polishing them. These people were accomplished artists.
How well are these statues standing the test of time?
Unfortunately, these structures are very fragile.
What can be done to save them?
Many islanders say that nothing should be done, that it's natural that over time the statues should crumble away. But I can't agree. Their art is an incredible achievement, and the statues are a symbol of the islanders' past lives and skills. Also, because they are popular with tourists, they provide employment for people. Perhaps a few statues could be preserved in a museum or under a glass dome.
Thank you, Dr. Novak.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Good evening, Dr. Novak, and thank you for taking the time to tell us about your work on Easter Island.
We prefer to call it Rapa Nui, the name used by the inhabitants. It's a very remote island in the South Pacific, thousands of kilometres from the nearest continent and 2,000 kilometres from the next closest inhabited island. In fact, it's the most isolated inhabited place in the world. In the 17th century, it was home to around 15,000 people. But after various disasters, the numbers steadily declined until the present day, when there are just 5,800 people left.
Tell us about the Easter Island statues.
Well, I first visited in 1982. I already knew that each one is about 9.8 metres tall and weighs around 82 tonnes. But what really amazed me was the number of these statues. There are over 1,000, most still upright. The enormous heads, carved out of rock, all face the same direction. The people believe that these statues have special powers and are placed in such a way to protect the people.
How did they move them into position?
1,000 years ago, the island was thickly covered in trees. One theory was that the islanders used trees as rollers. It was thought that the islanders destroyed every tree on their island for this purpose. But now we believe that teams of around 20 people, using ropes, rocked the statue back and forth, each time moving it forward a little more. We no longer think that animals were involved in transporting the statues.
Have you made any other discoveries recently?
In 2012, we found that the stone heads actually have bodies. These are well hidden, buried deep in the earth. We can now see that some statues are even bigger than we thought. There's also evidence that the statues were painted at one time. We know that the islanders painted their own bodies in a similar way.
Have archaeologists found anything else there, apart from the statues?
We have unearthed over 500 stone tools, showing that different tools were used for different types of carving. There are axes and picks for coarse work, thin, sharp blades for detailed work, and small tools for rubbing the surfaces and polishing them. These people were accomplished artists.
How well are these statues standing the test of time?
Unfortunately, these structures are very fragile.
What can be done to save them?
Many islanders say that nothing should be done, that it's natural that over time the statues should crumble away. But I can't agree. Their art is an incredible achievement, and the statues are a symbol of the islanders' past lives and skills. Also, because they are popular with tourists, they provide employment for people. Perhaps a few statues could be preserved in a museum or under a glass dome.
Thank you, Dr. Novak.
That is the end of question 10 and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers. Thank you, everyone.